Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
So when did you first become aware of this? Can you actually trace it back to a time?
Going back to my own sort of education, and when I sort of studied English at university, I was aware of it's what the German sociologist Adorno called the culture industry, but Adorno sort of contrasted the culture industry with sort of a few sort of lone voices in the wilderness who were still trying to, still sort of genuine creators of, well, I suppose literature and music, which are his sort of main areas of research, and he contrasted them with the sort of the all-pervasive culture industry, which I suppose he would just say is commercially sort of was artistically bankrupt and sort of not worth detailed study. Although I'm not saying I agree totally with what he wrote, because I, like yourself, I was a big fan of cinema as well, and I don't know quite where that, it just comes from being perhaps an only child and watching lots of films on television when I was growing up and being quite emotionally stirred by, a number of them. But when I left school, the school I went to, they didn't encourage me to study film at university because it wasn't really sort of a serious subject back then, and sort of, well, we're talking about the sort of late 80s, I suppose, and then sort of English was the way I was sort of led. I mean, I obviously enjoyed English as well, so that's what I ended up studying, and film has always been a kind of outside interest or something that I've sort of written about separately and afterwards as well, and I still do sort of like cinema. So I haven't lost, I don't know, if you're talking about sort of a process of disillusionment and sort of finding out that some of the people you might have sort of had as heroes and sort of the writers and filmmakers may turned out to be sort of not the people you thought they were. I'm not sure if I, let's say, had a thought a book was a great novel or a great film, I'm not sure whether my views about that has changed really, but I think that I have become, I suppose this is a lot more recently aware that culture, or sort of the, you call it that, it's a sort of problematic term really, sort of the sort of those writers and filmmakers, their careers could have been sort of encouraged, or sort of those who cooperated, let's say, with the prevailing paradigm, or as I think there is. I mean, censorship isn't the right word, because there isn't sort of really any censorship, but well, there used to be. But I mean, I think there was another critic, a social critic in America called Paul Goodman, who I think he said that there is always censorship because it's all based on selection, and so it's those people who select what to publish, what films to make, who is not usually the maker. I mean, you can write a book, but it's not to say you're not the one you can self-publish now, of course, but sort of if you're going to get a bestseller or something, it's all potentially not in your hands, it's in the hands of the publisher or other people beyond you who you obviously, and then so that could mean it's quite possible that there might be sort of great novels lying unread because they've never seen the light of day, never been published. I suppose it's possible, isn't it?
Well, Gary Height, who was on this podcast, he's a literary agent, and he stated outright that as an agent, he found out that the best, in his opinion, the best fiction in America is unpublished.
Right. Well, I must say, I worked for a literary agency for quite a while, and we used to get a lot of unsolicited manuscripts coming in through the door, you know, every day. And I got to say, and I used to read through, well, I didn't read from beginning to end, but you just sort of read the first 10 or so, 20 pages or a few chapters, and I not once, I have to say, did I find that I'd sort of discovered a masterpiece that sort of, you know, deserved to be, you know, read by the world. I'd like to think that I you know, was looking out for that, but I did not come across anything like that in my experience anyway.
How long were you working as an agent?
Well, on and off, it's about over 10 years, 10, 15, yeah, about 10 years, just over 10 years. As I say, we had a number of clients who were both fiction and or non-fiction writers as well. One particular I'd not heard of before I went there, who I had found a profound affinity with, who I think he wasn't really published until his middle age, sort of about 50 or something, and he was sort of writer of the supernatural, a man called Robert Aikman, who I, you know, regard as a great short story writer. He was not, and I was going through after him, well, he'd already died, so I didn't know him personally, but his secretary, after she died, I did go through her sort of archive of papers and things, and it was interesting reading correspondence with you know, rejection letters from publishers saying, we like this, it's very high standard of writing, but we unfortunately can't find a place of, to, you know, can't find a way of publishing it. So it's all about sort of marketing, I suppose, but it's then whether it's just the way the you know, the way the commercial sort of publishing world works. And I mean, I think that's how I interpreted it at the time. It's nothing really sinister about sort of censoring someone's work. It was just about profits, really, isn't it? And it's just money and making money back as a publisher.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, this is where your experience would be useful, because I don't have that experience. I think that it's not an either-or thing in terms of whether it's censorship or whether it's just commercialism, right? Like, there's a... it seems as though that would be a way to... implement censorship on a large scale over a long period of time without it actually appearing to be or even being censorship is you as you say, you're selective in emphasis, and so you consciously direct the kind and shape the kind of values which people have, and thereby what is commercial and what isn't. And so then at a certain point the system becomes self-regulating and self-censoring, so that a person doesn't have to say, oh, we can't publish this because X, Y, and Z, and they just say it's not going to sell, and they may even believe it. I mean, I'm just speculating here in terms of how it may not be either or.
Well, so you could say maybe there are two types of writers. There's a writer who writes themselves out of their own inner kind of needs to write something, and then there's another writer who writes for an audience, or writes, as the film distributor said, I remember saying, you've got to make films for an audience and give the public what they want. That old phrase. So there's that, and there's plenty of people who obviously all too willing to do that. And there's a much smaller number, a minority, who will write for themselves, because in a way they don't have any choice. Maybe it's a very strong drive or feeling. Now, that doesn't mean their work is necessarily better, though. It means there's something stronger that's driving them, and it doesn't matter about what the public wants. But that's a question whether because I suppose what that implies is that they may be driven by forces inside them that maybe, you know, like the unconscious, which is stronger than the conscious. I think the best work is a combination of the two. It's a combination of your unconscious drives and your conscious control of those drives. That's what I would say anyway.
Certainly what I would have said once, like when I was writing about movies, I even kind of wrote a book about it, Dogville versus Hollywood, and how the best movies were neither independent nor mainstream. They were a combination. So like The Godfather being the obvious example, this was a studio-directed project. It was a commercial enterprise from day one, but they wanted to somehow inject it with vitality, and so they picked some mostly unknown guy just because he was Italian, and it turned out, you know, lightning struck, and Coppola made the Godfather movie that we got, which is actually this combination of crass commercial agendas with an individual sensibility. The Wild Bunch is another good example. They're made to be commercial movies with commercial motivations, but part of the industry, in this case the film industry, the way that it seeks out success is through novelty. It wants to inject novelty into the medium, and so it does look for these outliers to bring into the fold, and then there's a period in which they genuinely are exploring their own unconscious, discovering things about themselves and the medium, which injects the product with this vitality. But then of course that doesn't last very long. I mean, like Coppola or anyone, name your artist, once they've been successful for a long enough period, they seem to become more and more restricted in some way, maybe because they think they found the thing they were looking for. I don't know, not having had that experience. So. But the other thing I was going to say about the censoring and how it can happen in subtle ways is that you've also got the self-censorship, which I think you were touching on, and why a person writes. Well, it does have to do with that, whether they're writing for themselves, in the sense of, this is my experience anyways, whether I'm writing to uncover something that's hidden from myself. In other words, the opposite of censorship. So, whereas if, I mean, because there is that part of us that I write about in Prisoner Infinity, the Guardian, that basically its job is to prevent us seeing the ways in which we have created an identity that will serve us in the world, essentially, or seeing it, really. It's a bit of a paradox, because the Guardian's job is to prevent us from seeing it, in a way. Originally it was to protect us from trauma, but then it takes over and it gives us what I call the crucial fiction. That's the narrative that serves us in the world, and then if we're writers or whatever, we want to write in such a way that will propagate that narrative and reinforce it. And so then we're actually tailoring our own work in a way that is self-serving, and that I think is commercial, whatever the subject matter. I think that's commercially viable, because it doesn't challenge. It actually doesn't really challenge. And this is where I'm... So now I'm almost at this absolutist position, which I don't want to ever take, but that anything that is popular or mainstream, even if it seemed to be marginal at the time, Hermann Hesse or whatever, pick your example, is already compromised. Somehow it's like the system is... It recognizes when something can be employed in order to sustain and extend itself, and those are the things that it adopts. So, yeah, I'm pretty much at the point where if I started to be successful, I would feel like I knew that I was I was doing it wrong. Because the margins, it's like the margins is where we want to be on the edge of what we already know. Not in the middle of what we know, if you see what I mean.
Well, so that's why you call your website the Liminalist, or because that is the area, isn't it? The liminal area is neither within or without. It's sort of on the margin, you could say.
It's on the margin. I was just thinking about this today in the shower, where I have some of my best thoughts, which is that the margin, because liminal means threshold, so I equate liminal with margin, but of course to most people it isn't. The margin is the end. You don't want to be on the margin, because then you're coming off the page, whereas actually if the margin is also a threshold, it's like what's outside the page, what's outside our culture, rather than trying to get from the margin into the mainstream. It's more like you're in the margin, let's keep going. And yet somehow staying in touch with the mainstream. I mean, this is my interest is still in popular culture, so I want to participate in the dialogue, but I want to keep moving further, deeper into the margins, and bring others with me, I suppose. And I think every artist does want to do that. It's just, I think we all underestimate the power of our crucial fictions and the power of whatever we want to call this thing that we're talking about now, the state or the memeplex or the spell, whatever we want to call that. And that was kind of more my question to you, wasn't so much when you started doubting your heroes, but when you really started questioning in the way that we are now, because that's what, like, we're discussing these subjects and it's quite difficult to talk about them because there doesn't seem to be much ground, because we don't actually know, how conscious these agendas are, as you put it. So often it does come down to we're just trying to figure out, do they really know what they're doing? Is it really? But that's not really the answer. That, I mean, I don't think there is an answer to that, is there? It's both conscious and unconscious.
Yes, I mean, I think there are forces that would like to control everything about humans, and and we might then go into sort of, references we get to sort of the future with humans being displaced by robots, and sort of certainly in terms of employment, things like that, which I find somewhat preposterous, but as an idea even. I think there are people, and they could be in positions of power, who have an idea that because robots are obviously far more predictable and controllable than human beings, then it would be far better for robots to be there to replace or somehow combine with human beings and it could be in the near future. But that seems to be something I'm getting an inkling of by my sort of obviously participating or sort of looking at sort of mainstream news and so on. It seems to be there, doesn't it? It seems I'm not sort of making it up. I think that wasn't there a few years ago. I mean, so strongly anyway, as it seems.
No, but we are. It does seem that both of us are tracing it back historically and seeing, not the inception, because who knows how far back it goes, but at least a line, of continuity. And so, what you're describing there, which is I talked about on recent podcasts, in terms of this seems to be this overlap between how can we program computers with human feelings and subjectivity to create AI, simultaneously how can we turn human beings into something that can be programmed. And it may be, it's occurring to me as we're talking that there could be two aspects to that. One being that, and they're really one, but how do we change human beings in such a way that they're susceptible to programming? And then the other, how do we turn culture into essentially a program? You see what I mean? Mm. It's the way that nature is, right? Nature, an organism's born, comes into nature, and all the different environmental influences inform the development of that organism until it's programmed, quote unquote, to survive in nature. So if you can replace nature with an artificially contrived, a scientific society like Bertrand Russell and Huxley and all those guys were talking about, then you replace nature in that regard, and you essentially create a program that will direct the internal development of individuals.
Mm. And you'll get this sort of elite who are controlling them, isn't that right?
Yeah, because they're controlling the program, and therefore, if it works in the sense that it directs behaviour, then if they want to change the behaviour, they just change the program.
Mm. And I think it was in Brave New World, you've got the controllers who are in the sort of that position, and then you've got a few creative people like Huxley himself. Who are sort of then going to their own margin on an island, isn't it? They're finding exile they're given a choice, I think, going away to an island with other creative people and having a sort of, I suppose, a very sort of mini, like a mini paradise, but separated from the main the continent, with the sort of the mass of people being controlled by a sort of ruling elite. And obviously, when I read that, I mean, I read that years ago and saw it as an interesting contrast to obviously Orwell's 1984, which is a sort of darker, it seemed to me a much darker, on the face of it anyway, on the surface, much darker view of things. But now I see that, and I also thought that Huxley's vision was a lot more more closer to reality than Orwell's, at least in the West at the time I read it. But I think that's maybe changing since 9/11, because I think that, and this is another area which you don't sort of, you touch on the idea of the sort of resources being behind a lot of this, the sort of the control element of by the elites. I mean, because we are living on a finite planet with sort of limited resources, then if there is a situation of resource scarcity, then the sort of the hedonistic sort of utopia or dystopia that in Brave New World can no longer kind of operate, and it becomes more like a sort of more overtly totalitarian sort of 1984 sort of society. And I don't know about you, but I sort of noticed that slightly, that sort of change from a sort of Brave New World to a 1984 kind of society in the last, as I say, it's broadly since 9/11, I think.
I hadn't thought about it, but I remember I had a friend back in 2000, when we were talking about the early 2000s, who was saying we're entering into the age of leisure. And he wasn't a naive person, he was quite paranoid. Yeah, I mean, that seems like a long time ago, that kind of optimism about however, I can't remember why he believed that, but just in terms of...
I think 9/11 was obviously a big event, wasn't it? It was a watershed event that changed. I mean, I think that was maybe the intention behind it, to change people's views.
The other thing is and their priorities. Yeah, and the other thing is the environment, of course, the environmental crisis, so called.
That's been around longer, I think. I mean, that's since
it has, but in terms of it being, I mean, now it's really just so firmly part of the programming that, you know, in order to be a conscious human being living on the planet, you have to worry about the environment and address the ways in which your behavior is, you know, impacting the environment. That seems to be become quite central in the modern consciousness now, and that would also be a anti-excess as the essence of it now,
yeah.
Curbing of our excessive tendencies.
And I think also it's inducing a lot of fear in people. I mean, that's the idea, so that if we're fearful, I suppose they were more easily manipulated. Maybe that's the idea behind the fear factor, to get us afraid, because if we're afraid, we're I think more easily led. I mean, we're like children. Like parents are telling them what to do, and if a child is afraid, I think they're more likely to obey than not.
Of
About that, the idea of resources as well, because I was just wondering how much of that is literal and how much of it is metaphorical. Because I mean, I do try in Prisoner Infinity to, even though I'm not very well versed on the machinery of capitalism or how it works or anything like that, but I do try and bring it back to some sort of base realities about how capitalism functions. I think as a way of counteracting the you know, the stellar cosmic narrative that we're being sold, that, well, maybe, you know, maybe it's not about spiritual potential, any of that stuff, maybe it's just about resources, capital. But I don't actually think that. I mean, as I get to in part two, as you've read in part two, and it's very confusing, because I'm kind of using the narratives that I think have been manufactured by some of these writers like Castaneda or Strieber, maybe not manufactured, but kind of distorted anyway. I'm kind of using them to get a sense of what the goals are of the social engineers, and it seems as though there's a subtler resource than simply capital, which. I don't know what, I mean, I would call it awareness, but I'm wary of kind of drinking the Kool-Aid there, because I don't want to, I'm not somebody who, like the leap that David Icke makes, say, to interdimensional reptilians, I don't want to or feel the need to make that leap, and yet I am definitely aware that, there's an unknown element in that. There's a sort of space that it's very tempting to try and fill in terms of, well, what are the actual goals here? Because, I mean, it's about those guys who went to the island. Well, couldn't they just go to the island anyway? I mean, why would they have to control the whole of society in order to go off to an island and live it up? You know?
Well, I think that was Huxley's sort of pessimism about the mainstream, about the mass of society. I think he would have said that he was a member of a cultured elite, a minority, and that only a few people were capable of, you know, enjoying themselves on an island with their own creativity. I suppose that was his view. So that's why perhaps when he went to America in the late 30s, he emigrated to America, and I think he was appalled by the sort of even back then he was appalled by the general level of unintelligence among the people there, that he started, it seems, to cooperate and with the, I suppose it became the CIA after the war, and with the creation of the counterculture and the drugs culture, which it's odd otherwise to explain how he could have aided and abetted that when he could see, in other ways, could see so clearly about you know, this was not really part of what being creative is about, but it was more to do with actually pacifying and, as I said, making the mass sort of mass of people sort of passive and unthreatening and sort of
compliant,
destructive, maybe only amongst themselves. So and that he seems to be have been, you know, one of the main creators of that sort of the 60s, not just him, of course, but he. And it's funny, he emigrated with a friend called Gerald Hurd, who I sort of need to read more about, because Gerald Hurd, as well as Huxley, introduced establishment figures in America to LSD and things like that. And also Hurd was one of the, I think he was the first person to write about flying saucers. The Riddle of the Flying Saucers is a book he wrote in 1950. And I think that was the first book about the subject. So it's just obviously something going on there that's probably, let me call it maybe sinister, because it's sort of they probably knew what they were doing was a way to, as we were saying, sort of control sort of mass society, which I suppose hadn't been done before on that scale. And it was like, after the war, late 1940s, early 50s, America was sort of unique environment for that to take place. And obviously, a number of the people doing it were actually had come from Britain. Not just them, though. There was a lot of sort of Americans, and indeed some sort of ex-Nazis, no doubt, who were given sort of immunity from prosecution because of certain knowledge and skills that they had that enabled them to work for the CIA and so on as well in post-war America on a sort of social engineering program, and whether certain different aspects of it. Of course, it wasn't just one thing. I mean, it was obviously, we don't know, because it's still obviously going to be classified, and we don't know exactly how extensive it was. I'm pretty sure it was larger than we realize. Yeah, and there has been one sort of book study of it. I think it was called Who Pays the Piper or something. I can't remember. I again, it's not a book.
Oh, that was Francis Saunders.
Yes.
Cultural Cold War.
Yes.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it was interesting. I read most of it, or much of it. It was interesting in terms of data, but it wasn't, I mean, it's not like she went back to Plato or anything.
No.
She wasn't taking a large, it wasn't really about social engineering. It provided clues to try and understand that, but she wasn't actually writing about it as social engineering. She was writing about a few particular programs, if you will, like the expressionist abstract art movement that the CIA was funding, and the Congress for Cultural Freedom, or whatever it was called. And those leftist movements that the CIA was busy promoting in the 50s. So there's a few specific cases that she focuses on, but I think it's a task that no one person could undertake in terms of actually trying to map it historically. But I do think that, and of course there's a danger of over-speculation, which I know I'm guilty of, because I just don't have the will to do all the research and read all that stuff, but in terms of hypothesizing the context for social engineering going back to the Greeks and beyond, I think there's consistent ideas and philosophies, and one of them, and maybe one of the primary ones, I think, is the notion that there are two kinds of people, two fundamentally different kinds of people in the human species. So, I mean, I was wondering when you talk about Huxley, I wonder if he persuaded himself at a certain point that, yeah, let's just keep the masses drugged, give them their entertainments, their crucial fictions, their hope narratives, the circuses while we feed them bread, because they're never going to wake up anyway. Like, if at some point he felt that he had realized that the mass, which I think is just is an imposed concept anyway, I don't think it I don't, you know, it seems like that's a social construct in itself. But anyway, what he thought of as the math, when capable of becoming self-aware. So the best thing you could do for them was just hurt them.
Yes, I think that idea is still very prevalent in a way. Well, it would seem not to be, and we seem to have sort of become more democratic, but I think that's all very much on the surface. I think that's just for show. I don't think essentially things have changed in terms of that's the way mass of people. It's not a word I'd use myself of people, but mass seems to be used. Would be the way that those controlling or apparently controlling things would view wider society as a sort of and indeed as something to be controlled rather than as something to be sort of encouraged and developed and sort of evolved, which would seem to be what humans are really about. And I don't think anyone wants to be controlled. I mean, I don't think, unless they're deeply afraid and terrified because of, let's say, there's an external threat, and then I suppose they can accept being in prison or being sort of told what to do and what not to do.
It's like herding, isn't it? When you've got the sheepdog that frightens the sheep in order to direct them, or the shepherd directs, I guess. Well, there's both, a bit of both, anyway.
Yes, but so whether that was part of Huxley's own evolution in the 1930s or something, I don't know. Whether he's always like that, I haven't read all of his books, but I know he was also a big influence on other writers like Anthony Burgess, for example, whose work was influenced. I didn't realise until recently that there's a Huxley work that I think had a big influence on A Clockwork Orange. That was a book Huxley wrote, again, when he had emigrated to America, called Ape and Essence. There's a kind of self... I think it's a sort of self-portrait. One of the characters in that novel is called Talis, and that rang a bell with me when I read that, because when I used to, and again, the agency I worked for used to send checks to Anthony Burgess for royalties and so on, and he didn't his account was not in the name of Anthony Burgess, it was in the name of the Talis Foundation. So he had got this name Talis, and I always thought it was the Elizabethan composer, because Thomas Talis was something, Burgess being a sort of musician as well, composer, thought he might have had a favourite composer, but I think not. I think it was probably based on this character in Huxley's novel, Ape and Essence, because there's a similar character in A Clockwork Orange, a sort of writer who gets, as you know from the film, writer who gets attacked and his wife sort of raped by this sort of barbaric sort of youth who... And again, that shows a sort of very, very negative, pessimistic view about sort of human beings, really. It's about sort of the mindless violence that, as you know, it's sort of the only way to control it is through some kind of sort of lobotomy or something like that, some sort of drugs, lobotomy, some sort of social control is the only way to deal with it. I mean, it's a very pessimistic view, isn't it?
Yeah, and it seems like it's both a self justification, as in, I mean, if your aspiration is to control society and be a director or a leader, etc., then you want to perpetuate the idea that society needs to be controlled. But and also it seems like a self fulfilling kind of prophecy, that if you believe there's two kinds of people, one's just a mass to be herded and the other are the herders, and you proceed accordingly, well, yeah, you can turn people into herd animals, or you can prevent, maybe we're all herd animals basically to begin with, or potentially, and you prevent individuation from happening because that's your own comfort zone, essentially, is to be in a position of control over others.
Well, definitely in terms of the British, you can see the British establishment or the British Empire, which obviously preceded America as a world power. I mean, we have still do have a sort of nexus, which is, you know, it's basically Eton and Oxford. And that seems to be still the power, the centre of power in not just Britain, but it's what we call tradition, isn't it? It's a traditional site, and it's interesting. They're both sort of based on the River Thames, which is also known as ISIS. It's a connection with this sort of entity now. It's a terrorist organisation, which is so-called ISIS as well.
Yeah, I didn't know that Thames was referred to as ISIS, though.
Yes, I mean it's still called ISIS around Oxford. It's the same river. But it's and it was originally, I think, Temesis. So it's like E-S-I-S at the end of Tame, because Tame is another town on the river, by the river. And at the same time, it seems that the power, the base is around the river. So it's obviously London is on that river, and also other places like, which have been important in the past, of political decisions have been made, like Clifton, which is on the river, which is obviously a big power base back in the 1930s, and then became sort of scandalous during the 60s because of Stephen Ward having a cottage there right on the river. And going back before that, in the 18th century, you had the Hellfire Club, which had its centre at Medmenham Abbey, with its motto, "Do what thou wilt," which obviously was used by Aleister Crowley later on. That was right on the river bank as well. So it seems that there's a long, and of course Eton College at Windsor is also by the river as well, isn't it?
So you sound like yourself, like you have some upper class background. Is that right?
Oh, not really, no. No, this is all sort of things that I've done as research. I mean, it's not something that I've personally. I didn't go to Eton or Oxford, so.
Well, I didn't do any of that, but I would definitely say I had even though they didn't self-identify as upper class, so maybe I'm using it in a loose sense. But you definitely sound more to the upper side of middle than the lower.
All right. Okay.
Just by your accent.
No, I don't really have any sort of antecedents, as far as I know. some people I might have met, but. Along the way, but no sort of close links. But I think this is all things that you can read. I mean, it's not just I'm sort of a sort of privy to sort of knowledge that's not sort of been.
No. I wasn't suggesting that. The reason I was curious, besides just personally, because we're talking, was that I was just looking at his novels. I read most of Huxley's novels when I was in my 20s, so I was obviously into him. I mean, I didn't read everything. I liked reading Aldous Huxley. And the idea that there are two kinds of people in the world is one I've had as long as I can remember. Like, even as a kid, I thought that happy people were stupid, so they were the stupid people. And I wasn't one of them. And then later it became, you know, who knows what seeded it, the different things I read, but anyway, I certainly developed an idea that I was in a very minority of people who were fundamentally different from the majority of people, whether it was genetic, whether it was energetic, or whether it was both. I used to think, you know, I had alien DNA and that kind of, you know, choose your fantasy narrative. Maybe it's not fantasy, but anyway, the basic idea that I was part of a very small minority who were superior, you know, who were individuating beings as opposed to not. I mean, to be honest, I still believe this. I just don't trust the belief, because that's what we're looking at today. And also, you know, my day job now is in a thrift store, is dealing with mostly the very kind of people, almost entirely the very kind of people that I considered the common people, the mass, what have you. And I don't feel that way about them, really. I mean, I don't feel superior to them, at least not in as I used to the same extent. I'm just interested in them as individuals, and it's more a question of how traumatized are these people, what kind of damage have they sustained? That seems to be what's more pertinent to me now and what's more real than the idea that there's actually, two strains of humanity and it's the natural destiny of one strain to separate off from the others while the other strain sinks into the swamp, into the mud.
I may have had that belief when I was a lot younger, but I think it's partly being an only child that I was a bit isolated, so it's maybe you do have these sort of grandiose thoughts possibly due to isolation. I think as I got older and interacted more with other people, I think I am, on the whole, I don't have that view with, but maybe that sometimes it depends. You can choose who you interact with, I suppose. So it's like I tend maybe to interact with people who I think I can get on with, and there's maybe a whole lot of other people I would never get on with because they are sort of, I don't know how you describe it, maybe rather sort of in thrall to the prevailing sort of consumerist, so if you'd call it that, the sort of, we live in a consumer society, and I suppose people who are kind of victims of that, who are sort of willing victims of that, I probably wouldn't have much in common with, or wouldn't want to sort of spend much time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like this podcast. I mean, I only have conversations with people for this podcast. I don't have conversations with people otherwise, unless you count, how much is this bottle opener kind of conversations. Mm. I mean, it's a bit more than that, to be honest. I do interact with my customers, but we certainly don't talk about stuff that's pressing on my awareness. And by the same token, I don't find many people to talk to on this podcast, because to me, just because you're researching this stuff doesn't mean that you're actually questioning your own part in it. So I do find it very hard to find people to talk to. So in that sense, I still feel that way, like I'm in the minority. It's just that I no longer have a strong opinion about, besides trauma, why was I not effectively socially engineered? Why are you questioning these things where most other people are just turning on their TVs and blissing out?
I remember you asked me about whether I'd been had experience with trauma in my life, or childhood or whatever, and as far as I know, I don't have anything like that. And I think that in my experience of other people, I may have met two people who I got quite close to, unfortunately. I say unfortunately because it was a quite a perilous thing, and I think their trauma, because it hadn't been worked through, I mean, they're still living with it because it was in their body language as well. Looking back, because I hadn't, these two people who I had similar body language, although they didn't know each other. I sort of knew them, but it was two quite distinct time intervals. But I sort of, putting them sort of together, the experience that I can see, sort of images of both of them, and they had a very, and they're both very sort of isolated in their, and detached in their attitudes and their superiority. They both had a sense of superiority, and I think it was, obviously, I can't, it's something that they never told me about, and that although one did say on the phone that there were things that had happened in her childhood, but didn't go into any more details. And she said, there are things I must tell you about my childhood, but I can't talk now because I'm in a shop. And so that was the end of the conversation about it. And who knows, because I'm not in touch with either of them now, so who knows whether it's ever been sorted through or worked through. I doubt it somehow. But
were they significant people in your life?
Yes, emotionally. So that made it more difficult for me to obviously I thought there was something that was wrong with me. And it was only sort of in one case, in the first case, retrospectively, I because certain things about things she told me and things that were happening in her life, which looking back, I realised, well, it can't be anything to do with me, because these things that were happening to her was quite sort of different. And it's nothing to do with extraterrestrials or sort of UFOs or anything like that. It's just sort of social, her social sort of life, which things happened, which you know, obviously things did not work out in a good way, and in her social life. But
so these were both women?
Yes, they were. But,
so they're romantic relationships, yes, you had with, yes, traumatized women.
Yeah, it's because it happened to me twice. I you know, then you feel that maybe it's something I'm repeating. I don't know. It's like you're drawn. Well, I was, and I don't know. Maybe in the first instance with me, as being an only child, I was drawn to romance and mystery slightly sort of more than most people who have, like, come from large families, let's say, who have brothers and sisters that can sort of relate to sort of on a daily basis, where I didn't have any of that. And then I went to, obviously, a single-sex public school, which doesn't make things any better, although it wasn't a boarding school. But so I was perhaps attracted by the mystery of sort of the personality that I couldn't fathom. And so that was kind of part of the romance, the mystery of their personality, but also looking back, trying to be as objective as possible, I think that it's something that's from their past, which some sort of trauma, abuse, which has affected them, and which makes them, and again, it may not be conscious on their part, and something that sort of made them affect a certain sort of mask, I'd call it, rather than a core of identity. They were affecting a sort of mask, a behavior, mode of behavior that wasn't natural. But it was also quite distinct. It was rare. I mean, it's odd, and I was drawn to that. But it's quite, I mean, in my life, in my experience anyway, I find that it's not a common thing. And that's why I'd say the idea of trauma, which it might, I think, relate to in their cases, I wouldn't say it's a common, and I hope it's not, but I wouldn't say it was a very common thing at all. And it's just like, you know, abuse and things like that in childhood. It's not the majority of people. Why? Because I think you notice it, or I did, or you notice it's a difference. There's something about certain people.
Well, isn't it possible they're talking about extreme cases, though? Or, I mean, extreme, more extreme. I mean, who knows what we're comparing it to? But I didn't recognize it in my own life until my 40s. So that suggests that it can be very, very well hidden indeed.
Oh.
with yourself, was it something you found for yourself, or was it, again, were you, did you have a someone else or a therapist or someone like that who...
It was both. It's been a very long incremental process, and it's not over yet. So, but I'd say 9 years since my 40th year, roughly, that the indications started to. I started to become conscious of the indications that had been there all along, and that's very much represented in Prisoner Infinity in terms of how I'm learning to recognize tells. Not so much in a person's behaviour, although that's true too with Strieber, because he does behave, his voice communicates a lot, but in terms of the fictions or the narratives or the beliefs that they cling to or that they adopt. But the other thing I was going to say is that also the company we keep, and there's a saying in psychotherapy, I guess, or wherever, that her wound met my bite, which is that traumas attract each other, that we're attracted to people with similar traumas, even if we're not aware, or perhaps especially if we're not aware of our own. So unless you said that it was, you were drawn to their mystery, well, but why would you be drawn to somebody's mystery just for the sake of it, unless it was some mystery that was compelling to you in some way? Because everything's a mystery if you haven't experienced it, right? But the mysteries that really draw us in are the ones that we have experienced, but we're not able to be conscious of, I think, because that's the pressure is of the unconscious to become conscious always.
Well, so, as I say, in both cases it wasn't a lasting relationship, and I think that if I had shared a similar past, then maybe things would have turned out differently, because I might have been able to connect on a deeper level, which, obviously in both cases I wasn't, and I'm still, late afterwards, I'm still sort of left with lots of unanswered questions, because I haven't got, and I don't think I ever will get to the bottom of what it was, or what that made them behave, and what made them, something in their past. I'm quite sure of that. There's something in their past that was so traumatic that they couldn't talk about it. And yet they gave hints in things they said, and also in the way, as I say, their body language and their behaviour. That these are symptoms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was talking about this just before I spoke to you about, what's the difference in how well people adjust to reality, however we want to put it, how well they function, to some extent it's got to be the extent of the trauma, but there are other elements too. I think it has to do with the way that the psyche deals with trauma, the kind of identity that gets constructed as a defense against trauma. So look at Whitley. I mean, he's a best-selling author with a nationwide TV show currently running. He's a big success in the eyes of the world. Not many people, myself notwithstanding, are pointing at Whitley and saying trauma victim. The first major influence for me that I was aware of anyway was a guy living on the street who gave me LSD and was full of all kinds of incredibly powerful ideas, let's say, and I was completely taken by him. It was like love at first sight. We didn't have a sexual relationship, but it was otherwise, it was like that, and he was a massive influence on me, and I had no idea back then that his behaviours might have been related to trauma. I just thought he was a super shaman. So then you've got to, if that's the spectrum, you can imagine all those in between who have adjusted to trauma in ways that aren't obvious on either side of the scale. They're not super charismatic, but they're not super fucked up either. They're just muddling along.
Charisma is an interesting word, because that's how I would describe these people in my life, as charismatic as well. So it's something I'm very wary of. Whenever I see someone has got charisma, I sort of take a step back. would treat it with some suspicion, anyone with charisma. I'm going back to your work on Strieber. You say something about trauma as a means to sort of usher in a new evolutionary stage for the species, and I wanted to ask.
Yeah, not me saying. Oh, that's Kripal and Strieber. Yes. Strieber, mostly. Yeah.
Yes, because I would actually argue that it's a sickness, really. Trauma is was a defense mechanism that leads to dissociation, that leads to a lack of sort of self, lack of identity, which really can destroy. So it's like, again, with these people in my life, and both of them, I felt so helpless that I couldn't actually. So it's a bit like, again, like a fairy tale, the sort of knight in shining armor who wants to go and rescue a princess locked up somewhere and bring them back to life, because it was as if they are both not really living. And obviously, I failed in both cases. I failed miserably. But that's because they were able to live, because it was like this very sort of they were barring themselves from reality because of something that's obviously in their past. And it's not, again, it's not something they had any choice about. It was something that was unconscious, because it was such a. I think it probably happened very early in there, because I think it's like the. When we have our earliest memories, my earliest memory is probably when I was about 3 or 4, or maybe even older. But it's like, and things happen to you obviously before then, and so something traumatic happens at an earlier age, then it's obviously much more powerful. And my feeling is that it could have happened to them at an age before their conscious memories sort of took shape. I think then makes it much more difficult to get over.
Of course, yeah, because you can't consciously process it. Right. You can't process it if you can't see it. And then that leads, that's what Prisoner Infinity is about, leads to those unconscious reenactments, the repetition compulsion. And one of the tales, not to make you uncomfortable by bringing it back to this, but is the people we're drawn to. Like, if you're drawn to somebody who is stuck in this amnesiac trauma state, doesn't that say something about something in yourself that is trying to resolve itself?
Well, you mentioned the word, brought it up, the word charisma. So, I mean, what is it about charismatic people? It's not just me. I think a lot of people are attracted to charisma, aren't they? I don't think it is.
They are, but I have hypothesized that is to do with people being traumatized. The people who are drawn to the traumatized charismatic are drawn because of resonating trauma, but they haven't managed to turn it into charisma. So then they see what they want. Oh, how can I turn my trauma into power? Which is what Strieber's selling too. So that's kind of the lure of the charismatic in some way, maybe.
I think power is also a very good word to use in that context, because power is kind of an opposite of love, and power is a defense. And these people used power as a means to distance themselves from other people. It's like, in fact, one of them was a singer, a musician. And so by being up on stage, one of the things you do is separate yourself from the audience, don't you? They are down there. You're up on stage as a solo performer, and you have your persona, a mask, your voice, and you don't have friends. What you'd have is fans. It's a very different thing. You have millions of fans, but no friends.
That's back to that separating yourself from the mass in order to be able to identify yourself as the leader, no? So you create the herd that you can control, then you're creating your own island for yourself where you get to be safe from any kind of, from being vulnerable, basically, to others. So it makes sense that a way to engineer leaders would be severely traumatize them so much that they would be driven to succeed in that particular context of having control over others and basically being on the stage as a performer who's herding the masses into ecstasy or into oblivion or both, whatever it is. That it's kind of both, isn't it?
Mm. Mm.
I mean, with the singer, at least. The singer, because this came up with Leonard Cohen, talking to Anne Diamond, that when she first saw him, she saw that he had the power to mesmerize audiences, like casting a spell.
Charismatic.
Yeah, a charismatic, exactly.
Whether or not I wouldn't like to say it's without exception. I would like to think there are other people who are, I would have thought even charismatic. I mean, it's possible perhaps to be charismatic without having been traumatized. I just don't know. I don't know.
It's an interesting term. Have you read about it in the context of anthropology and shamanism?
I've read a little about that, but I suppose with my anthropology background, that's been in a much more sort of, I suppose you'd call it before shamanism. You see, there was if you have communal rituals on a monthly, say monthly basis, then there isn't one sort of leader. I mean, you have two groups. You have two groups, and you have it's a bit like a sort of act as an audience, but I would like to think it's more participatory, sort of more communal, because everyone is essential, and it's like the original sort of art is inseparable from economics or sort of economic activity as well, whereas of course now it's completely separate, the two things, but because it's all about hunting. And so the ritual is about mimicking a hunted animal, the animal that will be hunted by the hunters, who's not the whole community. It's like the strong sort of men who are the best hunters go hunting in the group. But the others who are sort of part of the rituals, of the females mainly, they're blood kin, and they are sort of putting on this sort of pantomime to sort of... tell the men folk what they've got to do, and then the blood, which is the blood aspect, becomes the sacred aspect of both parts of it. So when the hunters kill the animal, then the blood which the animal spills makes that animal sacred, so which means they can't eat it there and then. They have to return to the females, and then it's cooked, and that sort of means it can be communally shared. So it's all about arranging society sort of to work in an economic way. And that's why, as I said before, that's why I think we've got ritual and language evolving together. This would be about, 150,000 years ago, roughly speaking, and probably starting in South Africa, coast of South Africa, southern tip of Africa. I think that's where the earliest sort of red ochre mining for sort of, as you say, artistic purposes has happened. And of course, in the last, things really changed the last 10,000 years with the rise of agriculture, and then more recently industrial civilization. That's when all of this ritual stuff gets separated off from the economic side of human activity. And that's when I would say all our sort of problems in terms of our identities begin. I mean, around 10,000 years ago, which is of course the opposite of what most historians would say. They say that sort of civilization, everything, is when sort of humans really started to evolve. And before then, hunter-gatherers were sort of not worth considering, because they're sort of, they don't leave anything behind. But actually, you might look at it exactly the other way around, because they don't leave anything behind, because they're nomadic, and they're actually going round the landscape. They don't build huge monuments or permanent settlements. They're actually not doing much harm, are they? I mean, it's like humans who've started to build settlements and cities and sort of...
Right, it's like an exteriorized self almost, as well as excrement being the obvious analogy, but also like it seems as though the beginning of creating a constructed identity, which is the defense system against trauma, that could lead to very quickly to, or could be congruent with this, what you're describing, of actually creating artifacts and leaving traces in the culture on the planet.
That could be seen as a, say, monuments, as sort of a need to separate yourself, and sort of it's where the ego takes over. So it's the need to announce yourself as sort of noticeable, that you're worth something more, because then behind that there must be some lack. There must be some
insecurity.
Insecurity. That's right. Deprivation, that something's missing. And I think that's what, I mean, you can look at this on an individual level about some people having that in their own traumatized childhoods, but on a very sort of wide sort of social level as well, we see that whole societies can be viewed as having operated in and still operating in that way as well. And it's obviously very, very detrimental to the environment, among other things. It's detrimental to the planet we live on. And it's as if we're sort of malfunctioning.
So that would suggest it's detrimental to the internal environment of the body as well. Because, I mean, literally it is. If you pollute your environment, you're polluting your body. But even prior to that, like it would suggest it's a reflection of an internal poisoning that's happening because of that trauma. Because that's what's driving of people. The insecurity and the anxiety is driving culture, the creation of culture to begin with. I mean, Sidney Sheldon brings it down to... No, Sheldon Solomon. Sorry, I always get those two more. He talks about the death anxiety as the inception of culture, awareness of our mortality. And that would seem to be... There's a sort of Gordian knot there of, like, the emergence of a separate self, of a sense of a separate self, was congruent with the emergence of awareness of a self that will die. So, but, you know, how did that become a pathology? I mean, is it because some people would say that the emergence of a self, self-aware self itself, is the pathology? Whereas... it could also be said that it's possible to develop a self-awareness in a way, perhaps less traumatic circumstances, more conducive to a healthy self-awareness, where the sense of mortality won't be unbearable and won't lead to these pathological drives to create cathedrals and all the rest of it, and wars, obviously, control others, and social engineering, basically.
Yes, it's quite possible. I mean, I don't know much about, say, Huxley's childhood, but possibly he was... I think he did have quite a traumatic childhood, was it? I think a brother committed suicide. I think his mother died when he was very young. I don't know much about it, but I think I have read that. So who knows, let's say, in his individual case, that might also have some relevance. But and I think people who are basically afraid of death do have some inability to live, to live in the here and now, and that could indeed be something from their childhood that's unconsciously present that they can't, as I say, easily or at all deal with. And that's why, you know, I don't know, we're talking about ghosts and the supernatural. I mean, I have an open mind about that, but it's odd reading about the subject that you've got people who come back as ghosts, seem to be people who have had traumatic things happen to them in life. You don't normally read about ghosts who have, like, very happy, had very happy lives. They've either had things like sort of, have either been suicides, or usually people have, like, killed themselves, or people who have been murdered by others. Mm. They're often the stories that you read about of you know, apparitions and so on. Sorry, I mean, if we're thinking about trauma, I mean, not for yourself, but for Strieber, saying trauma is a way of evolving, taking things to a next evolutionary stage. I mean, I mean, there are things that I think have been discussed in sort of paranormal circles that might be overlapped with intelligence circles since the war, in which these sorts of things, as I say, might have been induced as a kind of energy or you know, we have the term psychic energy, don't we? As if it can be another kind of force that can actually give an advantage, let's say, to other powers, let's say, if this was happening, say, in the Cold War. weak. And
well, yeah, so that's the collateral that I was touching on, you know, what's the resource, what's the deepest resource? I was saying awareness, but that's what you're calling psychic energy. It could be life force, could be libido, but this mysterious element that does seem to translate into a currency if it can be harnessed.
Yes.
But perhaps it can only be harnessed if it's hacked into, like if it's accessed in a way that is invasive. Because if it's just naturally distributed in the organism and the environment, it's just going to go where it goes. You can't direct a river, right, without building a dam, without actually blocking the natural flow. And so this seems to relate to charisma, back to charisma again, like, because if charisma is a way to direct, or the result of directing that psychic energy, whatever we call it, into the conscious identity, I'm losing the terminology because it's new ground, but if it's a way of directing it anyway, that somebody who can direct their psychic energy has charisma, let's say, then that, of course, that translates into social influence, power.
Yes, and that's to be contrasted with empathy and love, because empathy and love is like sort of using that energy with other people and not presenting it as a power or energy in itself that can control other people's, or at least other people's sort of, or get other people's attention, their reaction. As I say, I don't know exactly what can be harnessed with it, as it's a real tangible form of energy or not. I don't know.
Been listening to The Liminalist, the podcast between, with Jason Horsley and Jason Wilcox. Horticulture.com/liminalist. Part two of this conversation will be up on the following Wednesday, which will be May the 11th, 2016. I would like to thank Paul for subscribing to this podcast, that is, making regular monthly donations. If you feel like doing so, or one-off donation to support me and this endeavor, which is really taking up almost all my free time now that I actually have a job, while this and the blog. So I'm not complaining. I said to my wife yesterday that I don't see myself as a punk or a hippie. I see myself as a worker. I just seem to work all day and sleep all night. But I do it for love and sheer enjoyment, or just obsessive compulsive disorder, I don't know. Anyway, if you'd like to send your support in some form or another, you can donate, comment, email me, write a review of Seen or Not Seen, or none of the above, maybe do some Reiki. Okay, next week's podcast will be with Isaac, after that Anne Diamond, and after that NKB, who some of you know from altercations at the KubaCon forum. May it rest in peace. Till next time, liminaling off. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Body and soul, you have to sing me to sleep before you go. So, say
sing me to sleep, sing me to sleep.